This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. American families used to be big, but that was in a time where lots of children meant people to tend or lend a hand at all the chores that had to be done around the house, around the farm, or in the family business. Today, most families, at least according to the 2000 census, have 1.86 children. Pretty good trick. There are many reasons for this, not the least of which is cost. Last week, Bloomberg News reported that it would cost a typical middle-income family $241,080 to raise a child born in 2012 to the age of 18. PRI's The World has asked select stations around the country to partner with them in examining family planning and family size. Beginning on August 26, they will present a series called Family Choices, Fertility and Infertility in Africa. And they've asked stations to focus on family choices in this country, and today we will. We're joined by Dr. Maria Vandergriff Avery, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Sociology at Catawba College and Director of the College Honors Program. She teaches courses in marriage and families. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. And Dr. S. Philip Morgan is director of the Carolina Population Center at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He also chaired the sociology departments at the University of Pennsylvania and Duke University and is the former editor of the journal Demography. His work focuses on family and fertility changes over time and across groups, and he joins us from Chapel Hill. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. And with us by phone is Dr. Lisa Neidert, Senior Research Associate with the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
It appears that today, at least in America, people plan how large they want their families to be. Now, this may get some surprises from time to time, but overall, they kind of actively decide on the number of children that they want. Is that a recent development, or have we always tried to plan, but it was kind of more difficult prior to reliable birth control? Is this a new thing, Dr. Vandergriff Avery?
It is a relatively new phenomenon. You know, with the advent of birth control, it really changed the way that we think about childbearing, and we have control over how many children that we have. Also, with the entrance of more women into the workforce in the last 30 or 40 years also changed the dynamics of how families go about deciding how many children they want to have.
And does this go over various religious backgrounds? Because it seems to me that some religions, well, and I know for some religions, don't believe in birth control, and they don't encourage it among their flock.
Right.
So are we seeing, for instance, more children in Catholic families than we do in Protestant families?
Well,
is there any research to back that up?
Ahead, this is Phil Morgan. There is a lot of research on religious differences. In the 1960s and 70s, there was a sharp difference between Catholic and non-Catholic fertility. There's actually a famous article called The Disappearance of Catholic Fertility that was published around 1980. So those differences have basically disappeared. The differences by religion that exist today are not so much by denomination, but by intensity of religious belief. So those who report on a survey that religion is very important in their life also report that they want to have more children than those who say religion is less important. So there is sort of a religious secular, modest difference of it's not so modest. It's about a half a child, so 1.5 versus 2.
Is there a trend? Go ahead.
So I know Lisa Neidert on the phone from Michigan has done research on this as well.
Dr. Neidert?
The research I've done really looks at the U.S. and divides looks at sort of family formation trends, and some of these would be nonconformist behaviors like cohabitation and moving away from the romanticized view of the family, so looking at cohabitation, late age at marriage, childbearing outside of marriage. And when you do that, you definitely see differences in fertility in the U.S. with the states along the coasts scoring higher on this dimension and having subsequently lower fertility than areas in the heartland of the country.
So what you're saying is it's pretty much what the country is going through politically. The coastal states, east and west coast states with the high populations and more urban populations are taking a different approach to families and a different approach to marriage than the center of the country, which is more conservative.
Correct. Although we did do controls for things like population density, so it's not just an urban-rural divide. There are certainly areas of the country where maybe even have a libertarian philosophy of keeping the government. Mm-hmm. I can do whatever I want behind the walls of my house. So sometimes that's not in particularly populous areas of the country.
Dr. Vandegrift Avery, has the ideal family size, the thing that people think about when they think about family, changed substantially? Do people in the 1800s talk about it at all, or do they just have as many kids as they had and they never considered it? And has that changed? Are people thinking about it more now than they did then?
Well, I think we're thinking about it differently. Mm-hmm. I think people have thought about it all along, but in terms of the value of children has changed a bit. So when you're talking about families in the 1800s, especially families who lived in more rural or agrarian mm-hmm. societies, of course they needed more children in part because they were economically valuable to the family.
They were assets.
Exactly. Children, of course, are still assets, but we think about them as different types of assets than we did. They're not necessarily economic assets. And as you mentioned when you started the program, in many ways they are an economic cost to families. And it goes to not just what children are used for in families, if you will, but also the way we think about rearing our children. And so now we think about how to best develop our child. You know, there's all these discussions and arguments about child-rearing techniques. Should we use attachment parenting, free-range parenting? What do we do? But the bottom line is we're spending a lot of time thinking about rearing the children and what's the best approach. And with that, oftentimes comes a financial cost.
And that's got to be something relatively new, because I think children in the 1800s were assets. They were part of the family. They were expected to carry their weight, depending upon their age and their physical abilities and their size and their strength. But today, there are children who I had to cut the grass when I was a kid. There are kids who do not cut the grass. Daddy's outside cutting the grass, and the kids are inside playing video games because they're living a different lifestyle. This is kind of off the topic, but when did that happen? When did that switch from children should be seen and not heard, and they should pull their own weight, to let's see what we can do for these kids to make them the best they possibly can be, and they are already great, and let's give them a blue ribbon for being on the planet? When did that happen?
Well, Dr. Morgan may have a more precise date, but I will say that, you know, it really started shifting when we started thinking differently about our expectations from our partners. That started changing so that we expect a lot from our partners in life. Yeah. And with that came what we expect from our children. And we've sort of shifted to Annette Leroux did a large study on unequal childhoods, talking about how parents parent their children differently. And one of the things she talked about, you know, there's some parents who use this accomplishment of natural growth model of parenting. So kids just sort of grow up, you know, you allow your kids to naturally grow into the people they're going to be and hopefully accomplish great things. Whereas there's this other tract of parenting called concerted cultivation, where we're trying to cultivate these children. And this is, you know, within the last 20 years that we've seen this change in the way that we are rearing our children.
Dr. Morgan.
Well, there's so many aspects of this. One, we're talking about the past as if it were a single past. Mm-hmm. The past was incredibly variable. There's a wonderful quotation. One of my former colleagues at Penn, Etienne van der Waal, and his wife were working in Africa. This was probably 25 years ago. And part of the interview with a woman went something like this. Bamako, how many children do you want to have? And she responded, what do you mean? It's up to God. And they said, okay, but suppose God were to ask you how many children you wanted. And she said, even if he asked me, I couldn't give him an answer. And they went further. Even if God asked you how many children you wanted, you couldn't give him an answer? She said, no, it's up to God. So I think part of what I want to say is that you've asked several times if people always planned families. This is in some contexts, in some places, people probably had the children as they came. It's pretty clear that in Africa, many people were much more concerned about spacing their children, having a child every 3 years as opposed to having the number. Another example would be China, where there's a very long history of concern about having a particular number and sex composition of children. Hundreds of years ago in China, in certain areas, because of the concern about inheritance and the like, probably one-third of female children were suffered infanticide, and 1 out of 10 males. So that was it was very clear that family size was crucial, so crucial that people made the rather draconian step of infanticide. So the way this has unfolded over time historically has varied dramatically. In the U.S., if we went back even to the turn of the century, there was huge variation in the U.S. In 1900, for instance, women in the Northeast had roughly two and a half children on average. People in the South and North Carolina had six or seven, and that variation has diminished over time. There's certainly been convergence, but there's still regional variation. The other things that probably worth talking about is that we're talking about what people desire, and I think it's important to point out that half of the conceptions in the United States are unplanned. Let me repeat that.
Still.
One half of the conceptions in the United States are unplanned. So some of those end in abortion, about 20%, but the rest of children born, between 30 and 40% of them are what demographers called unplanned, meaning that at the time of conception, people did not intend to have children. Mm. So now some of those children that I've called that we say are unplanned, some of them people wanted to have children, they just wanted to have them at a later time. But other children are what, again, demographers call, quote, unwanted children. That means at the time these children were conceived, parents had really had all the children they wanted to have. So one of the differences with the U.S. is the large proportion of children who are unplanned and unwanted. About between 10 and 20% of children, parents retrospectively will report that at the time they became pregnant, they really intended to have no additional children. So you stated at the beginning that the TFR, the total fertility rate in the U.S., is about 1.86, and you made the joke that it's hard to have 1.86 kids, but that's the mean. That's really one of the highest fertility rates in the world for a developed country. So we probably should talk a little bit about the intentions for births and what happens when people have roughly one half of these conceptions that were unintended.
And we will, but we have to take a break. And I want to find out when we come back, is there a consensus in this country or around the world, and it must change in various states, since we have more people, more births here, is there a consensus on what constitutes the right size family? We'll do that when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. The kickoff to a new era at UNC Charlotte is coming up. At the very end of the month, August 31st, college football comes to Charlotte in a big way. A new stadium has been built, even as new coaches have been building a new 49er football program. All that's left is to play the first game and talk to the coach, the athletic director, and the chancellor, which we will do tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, texting while driving caused nearly 200,000 car accidents in 2011. Filmmaker Werner Herzog spotlights the problem with a new public service announcement, The Dangers of Texting Behind the Wheel.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about planning and family size and how the nature of that has been changing over the last several decades. Dr. Maria Vandergriff Avery is an associate professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at Catawba College. He's in our studio. Dr. Philip Morgan is director of the Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill, where he is this morning. And Dr. Lisa Neidert is the senior research associate in the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. Dr. Neidert, in the best of all, there are many considerations that people have to think about when they decide to have children and how many children they want to have. But in the best of all possible worlds, in the United States, if there were no considerations, economic or otherwise, what would the average American say they would like? What do they think constitutes the right size family?
First of all, this isn't really my area of expertise on the expectations, but I think there's been a strong normative to have children, and two is having two children is probably the modal response. And then even nowadays when the TFR is below two, the next responses are usually three and more as opposed to one and zero, although women end up having these smaller family sizes. So I think nowadays, not in 1850, but nowadays, two is probably the modal response on family size. Now, Phil Morgan can talk a little bit more on how that's measured. It's not typically done just asking somebody. Well, sometimes it's asked in the general social survey asking just everybody, but often it's asked, do you want to have another child? Or are you expecting to have another child? So it's putting it in a little bit more direct action.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is your area of expertise, Dr. Neidert, and we do have these more non-traditional families forming, unmarried people having
right.
children, unmarried single mothers having children, the father is nowhere to be found. Are they doing this because of recreational sex? Are they doing this because they want children and they want that family unit, whether or not there is a two-parent household or whether or not they are married? And in those cases, are they actively thinking about how many children they want to have, or does it just happen?
Well, that's a lot of questions,
yes,
but I will say, well, first of all, there has been a change in marriage in the U.S. There is now very much a class divide in marriage to where college-educated women are still getting married, and high school grads and high school dropouts are less likely to be getting married. And some of that is they desire to get married, they want to have children, but they're looking and not seeing that the partner has great job prospects, and so they're wanting to get married when they can afford the marriage, as opposed to the shotgun marriages of the past where, oh my God, I'm pregnant, I better get married. Mm-hmm. So are these, I believe a good number of these pregnancies are not planned, but they end up carrying them to term. And I see some of the very late, one of the age groups that has unmarried childbearing that would maybe surprise people sometimes is the 35 to 39 age group. And I see this as pretty purposive of, I don't have a partner, but I really want to have a child, and I go ahead and have a birth. And that's quite purposive, not a large proportion happening, but I see that as far more purposive than the 20-21-year-old who finds themselves pregnant and carries it to term.
Dr. Vandegrift Avery, you're the sociologist here. This is obvious. It seems to me this must be a relatively new development. And do we understand what's driving this? The fact that high school dropouts are having children out of wedlock, while other people of higher socioeconomic strata decide to get married.
Well,
and why that became acceptable.
Well, you know, as Dr. Neidert said, she's, you know, exactly, I would concur with everything she said, and that is basically that what we've seen is that highly educated women are waiting to marry until they finish their education, and then they're waiting to have children until they are, most often, I mean, clearly, this is the pattern, this is not true of all, but that we're seeing that they wait to get married, then they wait to have children until after they are married. Women who are less educated are oftentimes, as she said, it's not that they don't want marriage or don't see marriage as something in their future, but they see that as sort of the end game. So first, you know, what we want to do, we want to finish school. It's sort of the same ideas. We want to finish school. We want to find a job. We want to get a home. We want to get established. And then we want to have children. And it just so happens that sometimes having the children becomes before all of those other things. Mm-hmm. And many low-income women see having children as one of the most important jobs that they will ever have.
Yeah. Dr. Morgan, you mentioned fertility intentions. Define that and tell us how important that is in determining, understanding trends.
Sure. Let me comment on this last question, weigh in on my colleague's comments. You know, things have really changed around non-marital childbearing. You know, Bruce Springsteen, who, you know, really wrote for a previous generation, in his song The River, there's this line, I got married pregnant, and for my birthday I got a union card and a wedding coat. Mm-hmm. Think about that, I got a union card. That means that when he got married pregnant, he could get a union card and get a good job and take care of her. What's really changed, and if you put yourself in the place of either the woman who gets pregnant early or the parents of a woman who gets pregnant early, what kind of solution is it for a 17-year-old to marry an 18-year-old man? What kind of future, what kind of likelihood will that relationship be long-term? What's the likelihood that the man will be able to care for her? So the conditions have fundamentally changed. So people are making different decisions because the old decisions really don't make any sense. There are no union cards to hand out anymore. Okay, you asked me about fertility intentions. I think one of the things we need to think about is people don't sign a contract about the number of kids that they want to have. It's part of a general plan. I'm sure my colleagues have done this in the classroom too. They've asked their students, how many children do you intend to have? And most students will give an answer. These are college students, but they'll say, I want to have two children. And then you say, what about a career? And they say, yeah, I want to have a career. So they say, basically, I want to have two kids. I want to be a doctor or a lawyer. I want to live in a big house, and I want to play tennis on weekends. They want to have it all. And what happens when you live your life is that it's hard often to get all of those things. And one of the big stories about fertility is that fertility gets postponed. As people pursue other things in their lives that they want, they decide to have children later. So those two children that they intended to have get put off until the late 20s and then in the 30s. And then people may decide that they like the lifestyles that they've grown accustomed to, and they'll only have one child or have none. That's really what produces childlessness in the United States. It's not young people in general deciding they want to have zero children and sort of pursuing that desire of zero children. It's the process of sort of living your life and the reasonableness of often postponing childbearing. Now, there is a strong sense in the U.S. that people should have two children. And Lisa Neidert said this exactly correctly. First of all, there's a strong sense that people want to be parents. They want to experience raising and caring for a child. And once you have a child, you also want to have a second because you want to have a sibling for the first. You don't want to have an only child. There's, again, a strong norm that that having at least a second child is appropriate. And people usually get children one at a time, not in lots. This is not like going to the store and getting a whole bunch of them at one time. You have them one at a time. And each child gives you experience. You can reassess how many children you want. Some people fall in love with parenting and decide to have more than the two they initially planned. Other people have one child and find that it's incredibly demanding. Or there could be something about the child, a birth defect or some difficulty with the child that makes parenting very difficult, and they decide that just one works. So part of this is a combination of what people want and how their life really unfolds.
A few years ago, Psychology Today reported on six family secrets. Secret number one happened to be one-child families are the fastest-growing family group, and it is a worldwide phenomenon. Would you agree with that? It's a worldwide phenomenon?
It's more of a worldwide phenomenon than it is a U.S. phenomenon.
Okay.
I mean, there are increasing – well, first of all, there is an increasing number of people having no children. For women now in their late 20s, maybe as many as 18-20% will have zero children. Probably another 15-20% will only have one. And again, that's primarily not because they started out wanting one, but they postponed the first, had the first later, and have decided that one is, you know, one is enough. They sort of rejected the notion that, you know, every child needs a sibling. Their child can have friends. They don't need to have a sibling.
Are they right? Because people do have this idea that they need to bring at least another child in the world so that their child will have a playmate, a friend, a mentor, a big brother, a big sister, whatever it may be. Are they right? Or can single children be well-adjusted?
Absolutely.
They don't have to. They're not going to be spoiled brats. They're going to be without a sibling.
Absolutely. Sure. That means they can be just as well-adjusted.
Does that put more pressure on the parent when they have a single child?
It puts different kinds of pressure on a parent if they have a single child. But I wouldn't say more pressure. It's just a different experience than having two siblings.
I think people have overstated the importance of having a second child to make the first child well-balanced. I mean, it's true that an only child will have a lot more interaction one-on-one with parents. But most kids don't stay home. They go to daycare, and then they go to school. And at school and daycare, they have lots of peers and friends, and they learn how to be social in those kinds of situations. I mentioned that this only child is becoming more common, especially in Asia, where there's a huge pressure for children to succeed educationally. South Korea is a great example where many people want to have two children, but they have the first child, and they invest incredibly heavily in the first child in terms of school, even at a very early age, teaching the child English. There's an emerging sense that it's more important not to have a second child so that you can invest heavily in the first, than it is to have a second child for these sort of social reasons. And that's one of the reasons that, again, places in South Korea, like South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, and increasingly China, one-child families are quite common, and fertility there is incredibly low. You mentioned fertility in the U.S. is around two births per woman. It's closer to one birth per woman in the societies I just mentioned, South Korea, Taiwan, and increasingly China.
I don't know which one of you to ask this question. We've talked about how working mothers and fathers, unmarried mothers and fathers, can have an impact on the number of children that ultimately come out of a relationship. But what is the impact of the presence of children in two working family households have? What impact do children have on suddenly this family unit?
Well, unfortunately, research shows that in couples that are married, marital satisfaction rates go down after the birth of a child. I always tell my students to not despair, that it's helpful to know this information. Maybe that can help you work through it.
And why does that happen? Because it changes the dynamic?
It changes the dynamic of the couple. We have really high expectations, and I think I mentioned this earlier, for what we want out of our partners.
Mm-hmm.
And we want them to be everything for us, right? We want them to be our our best friends, our confidants. We want to have great conversation, great sex, great everything. And all of those things are hard to have, even in a situation where there are no children. When you put children in the mix, things are a little more difficult. You're exhausted. You're now renegotiating roles that perhaps that you had figured out before the children came into the picture. So those are up for grabs again. And so it creates a lot of strain on the relationship.
And what's the impact of two working parents on the lives of their children? Because we used to have at least one stay-at-home parent. That's probably not the case in the majority of cases today. So what's the impact on children?
I'll give one of my colleagues the opportunity to answer, or I'm glad to talk more.
I'm not sure which one of you would be the expert in that area, Dr. Neidert or Dr. Morgan.
Well, I guess what I'll say is that we've been talking quite a bit about these sort of shared norms and these expectations. And when I was in college, all of my classmates had there were four kids in their family, and that was true of me as well. So the only child person was an oddity, mm-hmm. and now only children aren't oddities. The same thing with the mother that worked at home or worked outside the home. That was not a middle class phenomena back in the 50s. The working mothers were working for economic necessity. And now you're working for money, but also the pleasure having a career gives you. But there's still a strong a decent proportion of people who say sort of marriage works better when the husband works and the wife stays home. That's still about 30% of people would answer that. So it is hard when you have for the kids, for the families to juggle everything. But as Phil had mentioned, kids are usually not on their own at 3 o'clock when school's out. They're in some kind of care situation, whether it's a grandmother, a cousin's house, or paid daycare somewhere, after school care. So I think it's just your expectations of what is going to work. Again, I don't think you always end up doing what you think you were going to do when you were 24, mm-hmm. 25, but I'm always interested in how much the child care costs at the time. When my children were young, it cost more than the mortgage payment on the house, which my father-in-law, the banker, had no idea that families paid that much for child care as he's.
Well, in terms of child outcomes for, children of working, children who have parents who are working outside the home versus children who have at least one parent who is at home taking care, the child outcomes are about the same. Children who have two working parents do just as well as children, or one working parent do just as well as children who have a parent who is in the home.
I want to find out when we come back how family size affects how children are raised. We'll do that when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Goddard School, offering childhood preparation needed for social and academic success. Learning for fun, learning for life at the Goddard School, goddardschool.com. Texting while driving caused nearly 200,000 car accidents in 2011. Filmmaker Werner Herzog spotlights the problem in a brand new documentary that Diane Rehm will talk with him about, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have a new but temporary email address. We're having problems with our email, and the new address, if you'd like to join us, is at ct@wfae.org. See, it's so simple, too. ct@wfae.org. Or other ways as well, and we're coming right back.
Martin Grable, president and CEO of Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, talks about underwriting on WFAE.
We get to support a community-based public radio station reaching a diverse group of local listeners. And I can't tell you how many times people come up to me and say they've heard our message on WFAE.
For more information, email underwriting at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In our studio, Dr. Maria Vandergriff Avery, Associate Professor in the Chair of the Department of Sociology at Catawba College. Dr. Philip Morgan joins us from UNC Chapel Hill, where he's the Director of the Carolina Population Center. And Dr. Lisa Neidert is Senior Research Associate at the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. I want to share some things that have come in on email in a second or two here, but I want to get back to family size. In previous times, we had larger families. We've already talked about that. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 children sometimes. Today, because of the working situation, both parents working, they're keeping their family size relatively much smaller than that. Does that impact, how much does family size, the number of children, impact how those children are raised? Because it seems to me the more children you have, the less attention you can pay to each of them. And has that changed because we now have two parents working? And what kind of an impact does that have? Who should answer that question? I do not know the answer to that.
This is Phil Morgan.
Okay.
Look, it's obvious that if you have six kids, it's going to be a different home environment than if you have one or two kids. I mean, I grew up in a family of five. I remember once I have three kids, and I mentioned to my father that you know, as tough as it was raising three kids, I don't know how he did it with five. And he said, "I didn't have kids like yours." What he meant was that we raise children differently when you have five or six. When you have five or six kids, rules are more important. There's much less now we think we always have to, and we do, negotiate with our kids. Everything is a learning experience. That's not the way that interactions occur in larger families. So there's certainly a dynamic difference. You can't think about a family of one child or two child and two parents interacting the same way that a family with five or six children would. But I think, in this conversation, a number of times we've talked about change, and change has been interpreted as problematic. There can be good or bad things about change, and I think sometimes we over-romanticize the past. Large families had some good aspects. You had siblings. You could grow up with siblings. Your siblings might be your best friends as older adults. But having more siblings does dilute or reduce the amount of time that parents can spend individually with each child. So actually, your relationship with parents might be stronger with fewer siblings. That's just one example.
And Dr. Neidert, you say that most Americans are unaware of modern trends to having children without marriage, increasing childlessness, and the rise in working mothers, which sounds to me to be shocking that people are unaware of that, but I'll take you at your word. You say that we've maintained a romanticized version of traditional family in our heads. Why have we done that?
I think America often thinks of itself as a country as being exceptional to American exceptionalism, and I think we this was from something on Pew, which is a research center in the Washington area, and they're asking people what proportion of births are to unmarried mothers, and it's in the news all the time, but most people were not getting that answer correct. There has been a lot of change, but sometimes the change is occurring in the United States and it's not occurring where you're living. So you're like, I am surprised that people don't pay for child care, because in my city, almost everybody pays for child care. But in other parts of the country, you've got relatives close by. Your mother lives five blocks away. You've got sisters that are staying at home. So sometimes our knowledge of what's going on is very much colored by what's going on in your particular
our personal experience. Our personal experience, yeah.
Scientists
have been studying why family size generally falls as societies become richer. and they have found that having a small number of children increased the economic success and social positions of descendants across up to four generations, but reduced the total number of long-term descendants. So in other words, we're having fewer children. They are richer because of that, because they inherit more. They have more richer experience with the family. But the number seems to be getting smaller and smaller the richer that we get. So they've sacrificed biological success, the drive to spread your genes, to societal success. And I'm just curious how long this can continue. Is this sustainable, or will we see a reverse of that in the future?
I'm not sure we're going to see a reverse of it in the future if we continue on the track that we're on right now. I don't know. Some people will always choose to have children, and some people will choose not to. And we're seeing more and more people who are choosing to be child-free, as the most recent Time magazine article pointed out.
Are more affluent people choosing to have fewer children than less affluent people?
Well, there's yes, in the U.S., more affluent, but more affluence is not just wealth. More affluence is more education, and more education produces that process I was describing earlier, where people postpone and postpone. You're raising the issue of contemporary concern about very low fertility, and it is the case that roughly half the people in the world now live in a country that has below replacement fertility. That means the fertility rate in their country is less than two children per woman. Now, is that going to be a crisis? Well, remember, I started studying population in the 1970s because I was concerned about the population explosion. Mm-hmm. So there's some good news in declining fertility. Declining fertility means that the population explosion is being diffused. We have about 7 billion people in the world now, and it looks like we're going to peak at about between 9 and 10 billion in another 30 or 40 years. By most people's calculations, 9 or 10 billion people is going to be plenty. Yeah. So let's not worry too much about declining fertility. But in some locales, I mean, some countries do have serious concerns. Where women are only having one child, that means that each generation is about half the size of the one that preceded it. So these are serious issues in places like Japan, Taiwan. Also, Southern Europe, Italy, and Spain have very low fertility.
And are they making these decisions? Are these decisions that are being made? They've made a decision to have one child or two children, or are these just things that are happening in their lives and they don't think about them?
There's remarkable stability across countries.
Okay.
If you ask young women how many children they want two children. The real problem in low-fertility countries is women are not having the children that they say that they intend. They postpone, and in the end forego having additional children, again to advantage the one or two children they have.
Dr. Nider?
I think some of this also at a country level, as opposed to looking at individual women, some of the countries with low fertility in Europe are countries that have very traditional sex role expectations. And so a woman kind of looks and goes, oh, my God, I can't have two kids and do everything around the house. And maybe the country doesn't really have child care arrangements that are very practical. A country like Germany is, if you drop out, you're really sort of expected to drop out of the labor force. And then you come back in, you really have lost wherever you were, your track you were on. So in that sense, the U.S. is a little bit more advantageous, even though there's fairly recent articles about the cost of child care. And not everyone works 9 to 5, so where do you get child care when you have that midnight shift,
right,
et cetera, or changing your shift changes it every single week. But the U.S. Is a little bit more, we see having children as more positive than some countries, and we have a little bit better work-life balance than some countries. So that will probably keep us at not necessarily above replacement fertility, but closer to replacement fertility than other countries.
We asked our listeners what they take into account when they decide on the size of their family, and here are some of the answers we got. Justin on Facebook writes, money, house size, car size, expenses, college payments, workload, cleaning, cooking, diaper changing, all things that they're thinking about. Cindy on Facebook, schools require more of parents these days, and kids today are involved in more extracurricular activities, which requires a lot of parental investment in terms of time and money. Personally, I don't know how any family can have both parents working and still keep their sanity unless they have a nanny or grandparents to help. We couldn't do it, and we only have two children. I had to quit my career. Don't get me wrong. I like my new career much better, but it required a lot of planning and some sacrifices. I mentioned the Bloomberg News report that the average middle-income family will spend $241,080 on average for 18 years to raise a child born in 2012. That means that doesn't take into account what it costs to send them to college. Housing is the largest expense at 30% of spending, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who also says that wealthier families spend triple that amount on entertainment and reading materials that as poorer households do. Childcare was the second biggest expense in more affluent homes, while lower income families spent a larger percentage on food. And health care costs pinched all household budgets. Does the average family understand that before embarking on starting a family, or do they find this out, Dr. Vandergriff Avery, as they go along?
Well, some of it, no matter how much you prepare yourself, you don't know until you're in the thick of it, of parenting. But I think this is related to why people are delaying childbearing. I mean, some of your listeners, as they pointed out, they're waiting, or the way that they decided when they were going to start had to do with trying to sort all of these things out. So I think we think about those things to a certain degree. Many of us do think about those things to a certain degree before mm-hmm. we start having children, and that may affect when we decide to have children and how many children we ultimately decide to have. But like I said, even when you think about it beforehand, until you're in trying to sort out all of those components, that it really hits you at that moment in a different way.
Do good or bad times influence, play a role in family size? In other words, are we going to see, they always say, like after a big blackout in New York, 9 months later you will see a population surge, a birth surge. Now that we've gone through this great recession where money was really tight, people lost lots of jobs, lots of people lost jobs. Are we going to see an impact on family size in a year or two or three? Are we going to recognize that really played a role in reducing family size?
I think
size?
We already have.
Well, it has. I mean, it's fertility has come down. Our number of births has come down over the past 3 years, starting right at the beginning of the recession. And that typically happens in economic downturns. There's a little bit of a decline in fertility, but it usually rebounds. But in this case, this economic downturn, we call it the Great Recession because it has been the biggest downturn in the economy since the Great Recession. And I think that there's a chance that women who were thinking about having children at 26, now they're 30 years old, and their economic prospects don't look good, or they don't look good for their partner. They've got friends who don't have kids. They may have student loan debt. So I think that this recession could end up having a longer-term impact on fertility than is typical. And one thing to consider is the women who were born in 1910, they came of age during the Depression. Mm-hmm. And they ended up having only 2.4 children, which was really a low point. They had a childless rate of 19-20%. But the women who did have children in that 2.4 average, 21% had four or more children. So there was still this desire, expectation to have children. That's not happening anymore, so the women who are having children now, the young women, they're not going to make up for the lost fertility by having lots of three-child families.
Dr. Alan Singer has written a book called Creating Your Perfect Family Size, and he mentions that these are some of the things that go into that. Social pressures, such as providing grandchildren for one's parents, not being alone as an older person is a drive to have a child. Second, having a second child so that the other child won't be alone. Having a child to cement together a blended Brady Bunch kind of family, and how far apart to space their pregnancies, all things to consider, he says. Are all these valid considerations, or should some of these come off the list?
I think that very first one comes off the list.
Providing grandchildren?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It used to be pretty common that once a couple was married, it didn't take too long before people were asking, is she pregnant? Is she pregnant? And I don't think grandparents would be asking that at all. There's certainly no expectation that children follow marriage very quickly. My kids lived one plane ride away and a two-plane ride trip from both of their grandparents. So you're not even always close to your parents. So they don't get to see the grandchildren, know them.
So they become less important reason to have a child. Dr. Lisa Nider is a senior research associate in the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. Dr. Philip Morgan, director of the Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill. And Dr. Maria Vandergriff Avery is associate professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at Catawba College. More information about the family size project at PRI's The World and what they're doing on that is on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Thank you all for the hour.